Osho, the sun rises in the evening. Talk from Zen. Discourse number 5. Given at the Osho Commune International, Pune, India.
The moon reflected in the stream, the wind blowing through the pines in the cool of the evening, in the deep midnight. What is it for? When we attain reality, it is seen to be neither personal nor impersonal. There is no sin, no paradise, no loss or gain. About this transcendentality, no question. Who is thoughtless? Who is birthless?
Man is a useless special, says Jean-Paul Sartre. Why? Man is a useless special. He says, because there is no meaning in life. Man searches and searches, and the game is nothing but frustration. Man is doomed to fail, because meaning as such does not exist. The message of Jean-Paul Sartre is that of despair, hopelessness, anguish. If there is no meaning, naturally man is a useless special, exists for nothing, exists accidentally, arbitrarily. Goes on keeping himself occupied in useless things, but the ultimate end is nothing but emptiness. Nothing is gained. Man comes empty and goes empty. The whole effort, and the effort is great, is just pointless. The myth of Sisyphus in the Greek mythology is of significance. It says gods were angry with Sisyphus. They condemned him to carry a big rock to the hilltop. It was a hard task. It was almost impossible task. But Sisyphus does it. He carries the rock to the top. And then the ultimate result is that on the top, the rock cannot remain because of its weight. On its own accord, it starts falling back into the valley again. And it happens again and again. Sisyphus carries the rock, prepares 1001 details, fights with the heights, and the ultimate result always is the rock rolls down back into the valley. Sisyphus goes down, it starts the work again. This myth is symbolic of man's life. From birth to death, you struggle and you struggle. And it is hard struggle and it is uphill task. And you carry a rock. And by the time you reach, the rock starts slipping back. At the end is death waiting for you. And death destroys all that you have done. It takes away all that you have created. And again, another birth. And the whole nonsense begins. And so on and so forth. If you look at the life of man, Jean-Paul Sartre has a point there. Man is a useless passion, meaningless. All endeavors utterly of no significance. Then why man goes on living? That becomes the most important question then. Why man goes on living? Maybe just because of cowardice? Because he cannot commit suicide? Because he is afraid? Another existentialist, Albert Camus, has said that the only metaphysical problem, the only, is suicide. All else is of no significance. Of course, if man is a useless passion, then suicide becomes the most important question. Everybody has to encounter it. Why not commit suicide? Why go on living? Sigmund Freud says, human life is more a matter of endurance than enjoyment. Then why endure it at all? If it is only a question of endurance. Sigmund Freud also says, and when he says something, it has weight. Because he is not a philosopher. His whole life he worked and searched into the deepest recesses of the unconscious of man. He is a psychologist. He has weight when he says something. It is not just a hypothesis. It is based on observation. He says there is no hope for man. And man can never attain to bliss. Because there is no possibility for meaning. Down the ages, all the philosophies and all the religions have tried to supply the answer that there is meaning, that the meaning is in God, that the meaning is in paradise, that the meaning is somewhere. They may differ where the meaning is, but about one thing they all agree, that somewhere meaning exists. But they all have failed. All the philosophies and all the religions have failed. Meaning has not been found. Man has been more and more disillusioned. He has hoped with every answer, and he has moved with every answer, and again, nothing is arrived at. All answers fail. Then man started thinking of revolutions. If philosophies fail, religions fail, then let us look somewhere else. Revolutions. A political revolution, an economic revolution, a scientific revolution, now they have also failed. It seems man is doomed to fail. This is the situation if you look into all the questions and the answers that man has asked down the ages. The question of meaning is the most ancient question, and meaning has not been found. Many answers have been given, many philosophies propounded, but they are all consolatory. They give you consolation. Yes, you can deceive yourself for a time while, But if you are intelligent enough, you always come to see the futility of it all. If you are intelligent enough, those consolations won't help. They are helpful only for the mediocre. They are helpful only for the one who has decided to deceive himself, who wants to pretend that there is meaning. Meaning in money, meaning in power, meaning in respectability, meaning in virtue, in character, meaning in being a saint. But if you are intelligent enough, if you go on probing deep and deep, sooner or later you come at the rock bottom of meaninglessness. Maybe because of that, people don't probe enough. They are afraid. Some unconscious feel is there that if we go deep enough, nothing will be found. So better not to go deep enough. Go on swimming on the surface. But Zen has succeeded where everybody has failed. Buddha has succeeded where everybody else has failed. And Zen is the ultimate flowering of the insight that happened to Buddha 25 centuries before in Bodh Gaya, sitting under a tree. What was the insight that happened? What is Buddha's unique experience? He didn't experience any God. He didn't encounter. In fact, no spiritual experience was there. He didn't see great light. He didn't see Kundalini arising. He didn't see great vistas and golden paradises opening. Nothing of the sort. What was his insight? And that insight is the foundation of Zen. That insight has to be understood. And that is one of the most important things that has happened to human consciousness ever. What he came to know? He came to know one thing. That if meaning is dropped, meaninglessness also disappears. This is a great insight. The greatest. If meaning is dropped, then meaninglessness automatically disappears. It has to be so. Because how can you say life is meaningless if there is no meaning? If there is no meaning, then meaninglessness cannot be possible. To make meaninglessness possible, meaning will be needed. If you say that your statement is meaningless, that means statements are possible which will be meaningful. If all statements are meaningless, then you cannot call any statement meaningless. How you will compare? What will be the criterion? Buddha's insight that early morning was that he dropped all search for meaning. He has searched long enough for many lives, and in this life also for 6 years he has been looking. And he has tried all the answers. All the available answers he has looked into and found them lacking. That early morning, when the last star was disappearing into the sky, something disappeared into his inner sky also. He came to a profound insight. He saw that life looks meaningless because I am searching for meaning. Life is not meaningless. It becomes meaningless. It looks meaningless because of my longing for meaning. The problem is my longing for meaning, not the meaninglessness of life. If I don't long for meaning, then what is meaningless? Then great joy is released. Existentialism in the West has missed while the inside was very close by. Just one step more. Courageous people, Martin Heidegger, R. Jean-Paul Sartre, R. Albert Camus, Verdeev. Courageous people, but one step more and Buddhas would have bloomed in the West. They remain clinging to the idea of meaning, and then despair arises. You want some meaning in life. For example, you go to the garden and you see a rose flower and you ask, what is the meaning of it? By asking, you destroy the whole beauty of it. Now you cannot watch the grace of the flower. Now you cannot look into the beauty of it. You cannot see the joy of the flowers. You cannot see its dance in the sun, in the rains. You cannot see what is confronting you. A tremendously significant blooming of existence. Now you are searching for meaning. You ask, what is the meaning of this rose flower? Naturally, there is no meaning. You cannot reduce the flower to a meaning. And when you cannot reduce the flower to a meaning, great despair arises. There is no meaning in the flower. Life is all meaningless, futile. Man is a useless species. You have fallen into a dark night. One step more, meaning has been dropped, and you have transform the whole world. When you drop the meaning, let meaninglessness also be dropped with it. How can you carry meaninglessness? How can you say man is a useless person if there is no use? If all is useless, utterly useless, the very word useless loses meaning. This was the insight that happened to Buddha that has developed slowly, slowly and culminated in Zen. If you understand this, you will be able to understand Zen. Otherwise, you will miss the whole point. Then Zen poetry will be of no meaning to you. And Zen painting will not be of any meaning to you. And these immensely beautiful sutras of the yoga will look nonsense. If you understand this insight, then great significance arises. Meaning disappears, meaninglessness disappears, but significance arises. And that majestic significance, that magic of life and existence, is what God is all about. God is the simultaneous majesty of experience, the simultaneity of the magic that is happening. These raindrops, the sound of it, this silent morning. This simultaneous majesty, this is God. Buddha never uses the word God because it creates problems. He uses the word nirvana. Nirvana means cessation. Just like you blew a candle and the candle has disappeared. The candle has ceased to be. Meaning disappears, meaninglessness disappears. And with the longing for meaning, something in you disappears. What it is? Who is desiring that there should be meaning in life? That desire creates the ego. That creates a process of egoing. The more you search, the more you rush for meaning, the more ego arises. And when you die, only that ego fails. Man is not a useless person, ego is. But if you are identified with the ego, then of course it looks as if you are useless. Buddha says, and the Zen masters go on resounding it, he says there is no meaning and there is no meaninglessness either. All is as it is. Don't ask for meaning, otherwise you will miss it. Just don't look for the meaning, otherwise you will create despair for yourself. Forget all about meaning. The rose is perfectly beautiful without any meaning. And so is the sun. And so are the people. The moment you raise the question of meaning, you will slowly get into more and more traps, into a kind of madness. And when you will not find meaning and you have put your whole life at the stake, naturally one feels frustrated, anguish arises. The myth of Sisyphus is significant. It was written in Greece. If it was written by a Zen Buddhist, he would have given it a totally different flavor. He would not have bothered about the rock slipping back into the valley. He would have enjoyed the whole trip to the top and back to the valley. It is beautiful. Flowers are blooming by the side, and the birds are singing, and the morning fresh air. And one is ecstatic, and Sisyphus is singing a song, a sodoka, a song of enlightenment. He would have defeated the gods if he has been a man of faith. Gods would have cried and wept because they had punished him, and he is enjoying. He would have enjoyed the trees by the side of the road, and the rocks, and the rock itself that he was carrying, the texture of it. And if it was a morning like this, and the rain drops, and the smell of the freshly wet earth, he would have sung a beautiful song. He would have shouted few haikus. He would have said, "This is it." He would have danced with the rock, around the rock. He would have enjoyed it. And then, from the top, the rock slips back, the sound of it. And again a new thrill, and the adventure of going down to the valleys and bringing the rock again, and all that beautiful journey, then the whole perspective changes. But the Greek mind was a logical mind. They created a logic in the world. They are the source of all logic. It looks a condemnation. Sisyphus is condemned. You can't see any meaning in it. What will be meaning? When Sisyphus reaches to the top and he is awarded a Nobel Prize, then you think there will be meaning in it? There will be another rock to carry. What meaning will be there? And the question will remain relevant: what is the meaning of getting a Nobel Prize? What do you think? If he reaches on the top and he becomes a millionaire, that will be the meaning? Or he becomes world famous, that Sisyphus has reached to the top, and in all the newspapers he is talked about, and his picture is on the front pages of all the great newspapers of the world. Would that be meaning? What meaning? Can you think of any meaning that will be really meaning? No, the whole thinking is wrong. If you think meaning as a result, then you miss the whole point. That is where Buddha's insight is of tremendous importance. He says meaning is not in the result, but in the act. And it can be only in the act if you are not looking for the meaning. If you are looking for the meaning, you have moved into the future. You have missed this moment. You have missed the present. You have missed that which is. And the beauty of that which is, the benediction of it, the utter joy of it, this is what Zen is. Zen drops the search for meaning because it is an ego search. The gratification of the ego is thought to be the meaning. Zen drops the very search for meaning, and in that very dropping, all kinds of meaninglessnesses disappear. See the beauty of it. Then life is, simply is. No meaning, no meaninglessness. How can you be in despair? And when there is no search for meaning, you are no more separate from life. When there is no search for meaning, how can you divide yourself from life? When you are part of this organic unit, this simultaneous majesty, this magic of being, this ecstasy of being, then you sing with the birds, and you bloom with the trees, and you dance with the stars. Then you don't have any private world of your own. Then this world is your world. And there is no idea of the future. Then this moment is all, it contains eternity. Friedrich Nietzsche has said, to have lost God means madness. And when mankind will discover that it has lost God, universal madness will break out. And this from the man who himself declares that God is dead. He is afraid what he has declared. He is afraid about it. He says when God will be lost, man will go mad. And that's exactly what happened to him. He went mad. He could not live without meaning. Although he declared, he dared that God is dead. Maybe he dared too much. Maybe he dared beyond his capacity. Maybe he was not able to absorb the death of God. It was such a shock. Maybe he was reacting and reacted too much to the other extreme. And then a wound was left in his feet. He could not live himself without God. He was a very egoistic man, so he could not believe in God. He had to declare God dead. But once he declared God dead, then there is no meaning. The death of God is the death of meaning. God has remained the meaning for centuries. Since man has existed on the earth, God has been the meaning. We can always look towards God, that life is nothing but a preparation for God, that life is a waiting for God, that sooner or later we will arrive home. That there is a home. That there is a father figure or a mother figure waiting for you. You are not lost. Maybe you have gone astray, but not lost. Anytime you can decide to move back, and you will find the home, and the home will not have disappeared. God has remained the center of all meaning. All meaning arises out of God. Now, it was difficult for the ego of Nietzsche to accept any meaning from outside. He wanted the meaning to come from his inside. The meaning has to be his, not God's. He didn't want to borrow it from anybody. He was a very proud man. He declared God dead. But once God is dead, all meaning is dead. Once God is dead, then there is no center in existence. Everything starts falling apart. Everything starts disintegrating. All other values are dependent values. What is good if there is no God? It is a derivative. It is derived from God. What is virtue if there is no God? And what is morality if there is no God? And who is a sinner and who is a saint if there is no God? And why not do this and why do that if there is no God? In the same sentence, when Nietzsche declared God is dead, he also declared, now man is free. Literally, free of all values. Free of all restrictions. Free of all responsibilities. Now man is no more answerable. Nobody can ask him anything. Now there is not going to be any judgment day. Now man is free. And whatsoever he wants to do, he can do it. Fyodor Dostoevsky says, if there is no God, then everything is permitted. Obviously. If there is no God, then all is permitted. Then who is there to command you to do this or not to do this? Then disobedience or obedience, both are meaningless. Then Adam cannot be turned out of the Garden of Eden. There is no God who can prohibit him. And there is no God who can say, don't eat the fruit of this tree of knowledge. And there is nobody who can force Adam to be obedient. And once God disappears, there is no sin. Because sin is disobedience. Sin is going against the commandments of God. Disappearance of God means disappearance of all values. Then man is purely an animal without any values. If there is no God, then man is certainly free. Jean-Paul Sartre says, man is condemned to be free. Condemned? Yes, if there are no values, then the freedom is going to be too much. You will not be able to live it. Life will become a chaos. Freedom will turn into chaos. And freedom will turn into madness. And Nietzsche is aware that if there is no God, man is going to be mad. He himself became mad. Last years of his life were of great madness. He lost all sense of direction. He lost all possibilities of direction. Then there is nowhere to go if there is no God. But Nietzsche is not aware that there have been people who have said there is no God and have not gone mad. Buddha is one. There is no God. And still, Buddha has not gone mad. In fact, Buddha says that you create God somehow to maintain your sanity. Your sanity is not true sanity. A God is needed to maintain it. Without God, you will be exposed. You are mad. God is just a trick. to keep you sane. All your religions are nothing but strategies to keep yourself sane. Make beliefs, consolations. Otherwise, life will be too much and you will not be able to bear it, the pain of it, the anguish of it. If you understand Buddha, to believe in God is just somehow to protect yourself from the inner insanity that is there. A real sane man will not need God. A really healthy person, a whole person, will not need God. He will be a God himself. Why he will need God? Nietzsche is not aware that Buddha has lived without God. And Buddha is not alone. Mahavira has lived without God. And Mahavira is not alone. Many, many other enlightened people have preceded them and succeeded them. In the East, the greatest traditions, Buddhist, Jaina, and Tao, are all godless. And yet they are religions. The West is incapable to understand how they can be religions. How can they call themselves religions? If there is no God, they cannot think of a religion without God. They are obsessed with the idea of God. So if God is dead, or God disappears, or is found no more, or man becomes disbelieving, then he will go mad. Nietzsche went mad, and the whole humanity slowly, slowly is moving towards that madness. He predicted rightly. He was a very prophetic madman. But Jain has no God. From where? Jain drives its sanity. From where? From what source? Dropping the desire for meaning, God is dropped. God is nothing but a created meaning, manufactured by man. The Bible says God created man in his own image. That is not true. Man has created God in his own image. That is far more true. In fact, to say God is the father of man is wrong. God is the son of man. It is man's idea. Man cannot live without God. That is the neurosis of man. That shows man's dependence. Man cannot live without a father figure. Man needs somebody to lean to, somebody to look to. Man needs a great support. Man cannot stand on his own feet. And that is the beauty of Zen. And that is the message of Buddha, that man can be on one's own. There is no need to lean to anybody. And God certainly arises in you when you are not leaning to anybody. Because when you lean on your own beliefs. They are dreams, projections. They are not true. Out of fear, you create the God. How can it be true? It is not your experience. Out of despair, you create God. It is a byproduct of despair. Out of misery, you create God. How can be your God a Satchidanand? How can your God be truth, bliss, consciousness? You create your God out of your unconsciousness. How can it be consciousness? And you create God out of your misery. How can God be bliss? And you create God out of your lies. The greatest lie is to believe in God without knowing Him. How can God be truth? No, God cannot be Satchidananda. Buddha says God has not to be created by you. you have to come to a point where you are capable of dropping all search for meaning and all longing for meaning. With that search dropped, all gods disappear on their own accord. All paradises disappear. They were nothing but dreams. You are left alone, contentless. And remember again, you are not falling into a despair. You cannot. A Buddha cannot fall into a despair. It is impossible. Hope has disappeared, so has disappeared hopelessness. The goal has disappeared. How can you be anxious now? Anxiety arises only because of the goal, whether I am going to make it or not, hence anxiety. There can't be any tension when there is no meaning. Then all that is left is play. All that is left is to live this moment. Then eating, eat. Sleeping, sleep. Then walking, walk. And each act is ultimate, and it has no reference with anything else. It has not to have any reference to be meaningful. It is neither meaningful nor meaningless. It simply is. That isness, Buddha calls tathāgata, suchness, is. Buddha calls this isness freedom. And the freedom is not like Sartre's freedom, as if man is condemned to be free. It is glory. It is great splendor. It is releasement. Releasement from egoing. Releasement from all confinements and identities. Releasement of the inner splendor. You bloom. Without any future. You bloom in the present. This moment is all. Buddha has started a revolution in human consciousness. His religion is not an ordinary religion. It is utterly extraordinary. It is rare. It is not the common garden variety. It is very special. A special transmission. Buddha's insight has penetrated the very core of existence. Zen bloomed out of that insight. What happened to Buddha on that certain morning in Bodh Gaya, under a Bodh tree, has lived and grown. It has gathered more and more energy to it. It has become a big river now. That is Zen. And Zen has something which is very, very essential for the survival of man in future. Otherwise, suicide will become the only thing to think. Zen can give you an alternative. That alternative is sannyas. Suicide means there is no meaning, so destroy yourself. Sannyas means there is no meaning, so you are freed from that hankering. Now enjoy yourself. Because there is no meaning, there is no destiny. You are free to enjoy this moment with your totality. Nothing to hinder. No God to be taken care of. No commandment. You are utterly free to be in this moment. The future is going to be more zenith than anything else. If man is to survive, religion has to take the shape of Zen. It will be more and more closer to Zen than to anything else. Because Zen is not a religion like Christianity, or Hinduism, or Jainism, or even Buddhism. Zen is a new kind of religiousness. Not religion, but religiousness. The difference between other religions is that of quantity. The difference between Zen and other religions is that of quality. It is a qualitative revolution. Zen gives you a new insight, a new vision. A life of freedom, of utter freedom. A life of spontaneity, of absolute spontaneity. A life of the moment, in the moment, for the moment. And there is nowhere else to go. This is going to be the future of humanity. This is the only possibility for man's survival. Existentialism in the West has created the atmosphere for Zen to pop up. Existentialism is half-hearted Zen, unconscious Zen. Zen is conscious existentialism. Sartre and Camus and Heidegger and Berdiaev and Marshall and others, they are just predecessors of something that is coming, that has really already arrived for those who can see. Hence I am speaking so much on Zen, because it has the flavor of the future. Man cannot remain confined in the temples and churches and mosques anymore. Enough. And enough is enough. Man needs the whole sky now. And this is the song of Iyoka Daishi. These sutras are beautiful. Go into them. The moon reflected in the stream, the wind blowing through the pines, in the cool of the evening, in the deep midnight, what is it for? Yokais say, if you ask this question, you are a fool. Can you ask this question? The moon reflected in the stream. Why it is reflected in the stream? What for? What is the meaning of it? Is not it beautiful as it is? Has some meaning to be brought to it? Will any meaning aid in any way to its beauty and benediction? The moon is reflected in the stream. Is not it enough? In fact, it is more than enough. What else you want? Why you think of meaning? The search for meaning is greed, and the search for meaning is mundane. The man who is religious will enjoy this moment, the moon reflected in the stream. The beauty, the grace, the silence. Neither the moon wants to be reflected in the stream, nor the stream wants the moon to be caught in it as a reflection. There is no desiring anywhere. No desire on the part of the moon. No desire on the part of the stream. But moon is there and stream is there, so the reflection. Neither the stream is worried what is the meaning of the moon, nor the moon is worried what is the meaning of the stream. You sitting on the bank are worried what is the meaning of this all. And if I cannot find any meaning, then why I should live at all? Why not commit suicide? Such a beautiful world. such a grandeur, such a magical moment, the moon reflected in this sea, and you, Albert Camus, thinking of committing suicide, talking about suicide. Can't you enjoy this moment in its bare nakedness? Have you to bring some meaning in it? Have you to ask what is the use of it? Would you like to sell this reflection in the marketplace? And when you can get a 10 rupee note, then you will say, yes, it has meaning. What you are asking for? What do you mean by meaning? A child is playing and the father comes home and he says, do your homework. What you are doing? Do something useful. Why the homework is useful? Because it is going to bring money later on. What else is its use? The play is not useful because it is not going to bring any money. We have reduced the whole life to utility. We have all become utilitarians. And a utilitarian is never religious. If you ask me who is religious and who is not, this is my definition. God is not the problem. Whether one man believes in God or not, that doesn't make one religious or irreligious. Because I have seen millions who believe in God and who are not religious. And I have seen few people who don't believe in God and are religious. So that is irrelevant. We will have to find some other definition. This is my definition. The man who only thinks of utility is irreligious. Then he cannot understand duty. He always asks for utility. You see a bird on the wing. The sky is clear and there are no clouds. And just the bird silently balancing on its wings far away. And you say, look. Look at the bird on the wing. And your friend says, so what? This man is irreligious. He says, so what? The bird is on the wing, so what? What is the meaning of it? He is asking, can we catch it? He is asking, can it be reduced to money, economics? Can it be reduced to politics? Will it help me to win the coming election? Will it help me to have a bigger balance in the bank? Is it going to help me become more famous? If not, then what is the point? Why waste time? Lao Tzu is passing. He is on a pilgrimage. You may ask, pilgrimage to what? Is he going to Mecca? Or to Kailas? Or is coming to Kashi? No. Pilgrimage to nowhere. Just enjoy. In the mountains and the rivers and the valleys. A pilgrimage to nowhere. His disciples are following him. They come in a forest where all the trees have been cut except one tree. And that one tree is so big. And its branches so high and so long that 1,000 bullock carts can rest under its shade. And Lao Tzu sends one of his disciples, who is a philosopher, to inquire what has happened, because the whole jungle has been cut. And thousands of workers are still cutting the remaining trees. But why they are not cutting this tree? You just go and inquire. He asks the philosopher disciples, because he is always asking about the use, the meaning. The philosopher goes, comes back a little puzzled and confused. He says, it is very puzzling. I asked them, and they said, because that tree is useless. They say that all its branches are such that they cannot be used in making any kind of furniture. They are not straight. Its leaves are such that no animal will eat them. When you burn the wood of this tree, only smoke comes out, no fire. It is utterly useless. That's why we have not cut it. And Lao Tzu laughed, had a hearty laugh, and he said, you see, the use of the uselessness. Now this tree has survived because it is useless. See the beauty of the tree. Because it is useless, it is enjoying the sun and the clouds. It is still alive, and the useful have been cut and destroyed. And he says to his disciples, be useless like this tree. Then nobody will disturb you. Then nobody will kill you. And you will be able to enjoy. And you will be able to dance. Look at the dance of the tree. Lao Tzu is saying that use is not all that is there in life. And to think that use is all is to be a materialist, is to be irreligious. The man who is always asking about the use and meaning is a religious person. The religious person enjoys. He does not ask any questions about life. Life is so beautiful, why waste time in asking? The moon reflected in the stream, the wind blowing through the pines, in the cool of the evening, in the deep midnight, what is it for? Yoga is saying, do you ask the question, what is it for? Then why ask about men? Then why ask about God? Then why ask at all? Asking creates a barrier in enjoying. Philosophers are the people who enjoy life the least. And it is unfortunate that they dominate people's minds. And they are the least enjoying people in the world. Mostly miserable. They are always asking why. A woman asked Immanuel Kant, a beautiful woman, that she has fallen in love with him and she wants to get married to him. He said, why? Why one should fall in love? And what is the meaning of love? I will have to think over it. And he thought and thought, and he read about love and marriage. And he thought all pros and cons. It took time, literally. After 3 years, he decided that it is worth trying. Because one is not going to lose anything in it. One may not gain anything, but one is not going to lose anything. And he has made many notes. It is almost a thesis in which he has written all pros and cons. And pros were a little weightier than the cons. So he decided. He knocked at the woman's door. The father opened the door and he said, now I am ready. Where is your daughter? And the father laughed and he said, it is too late. Now she has one child too. She is already married. You took too long in thinking. You have missed this point. Even love for a philosopher becomes a problem. Beauty becomes a problem. joy becomes a problem. He goes on why, asking why. I have heard about a patient must have been a philosopher. His psychoanalyst suggested him to go to the hills for rest. So he went there. After a few days, a telegram came to the psychoanalyst. I am feeling very happy. Why? Now explain. Even happiness has to be first explained. And don't laugh at it, because so many people come to me. When they start feeling happy, when they start feeling joyous, when meditation starts blooming in them, they come to me very much puzzled, disturbed, very much uncomfortable. They ask me, I'm feeling very joyous. Why? Misery is okay, but joy, something unexpected is happening. Something that they have never expected. Something for which they are not prepared. And remember one thing. If you ask why about misery, it can be answered. But if you ask why about joy, it cannot be answered. Because misery is unnatural. So it has a cause. And joy is just a natural outflow. It has no cause. If you go to the doctor and you ask, I am feeling healthy, why? He cannot answer you. He cannot explain why. He cannot send you to the x-ray, cardiogram and other checks. Because health cannot be checked in any way. There is no machine. Then can say that you are healthy and can show the cause. You are healthy because you are alive. You are healthy because you should be healthy. Health is natural. But if you go to the doctor and you are ill, he can show you why you are ill. Maybe it is tuberculosis or cancer or something else. Causes can be found. Causes can be found only for that which is unnatural. Joy is just natural. Never ask why. Never ask why about love, about joy, about duty, about God, about life. The moon reflected in the stream, the wind blowing through the pines, in the cool of the evening, in the deep midnight, what is it for? It is not goal-oriented. It is not a means to some other end. It is a means unto itself. If you ask the why, you will create trouble. And when the question will not be answered, you will feel that it is meaningless. Despair will arise if you ask why. Because the nature is not in any way obliged to answer you. And it doesn't answer any foolish, silly, stupid questions. The moon will laugh and go on rushing into the sky. And the stream will laugh and go on rushing towards the ocean. And the wind will go on blowing through the pines. Neither the pines will bother to ask or answer, nor the wind. You will be left alone. The moment man asks why, he is left alone. He is cut off from the totality of existence. Drop the why, and suddenly you are one with the wind and the pines and the stream and the moon. And that oneness is God. God is not a theological concept. It is an existential experience. That oneness is God. When the moon is not separate there, but bridged with you. And the stream is not separate there, but is bridged with you. When everything is woven in one pattern. When the leaf on the tree and the farthest distant star are both joined in you. And there is no why. Ask the why and you are cut off. You become isolated. You become an island. And then misery arises. And fear. And loneliness. Drop the why and you are not alone. You are one with existence. How you can be alone? And the moon is there, and the wind is there, and the pine, and the stream, and the mountains, and the stars, and this vast infinite existence is yours. When we attain reality, it is seen to be neither personal nor impersonal. This is attaining to reality when you don't ask the why. When you drop the longing, the neurotic longing for meaning. That neurotic longing is driving you into such despair that life has become almost impossible. It is a miracle how you go on living. Yes, Freud may be right. As far as you are concerned, human life is more a matter of endurance than enjoyment. He himself never enjoyed life. He endures. But that is ugly, to endure. To endure such benediction in which you can disappear. In which you need not remain separate, in which you can become part of the dance and the song. When we attain reality, this is attaining reality. Dropping the question why, dropping philosophical attitudes towards life, dropping the longing for meaning, and you attain to reality. Suddenly you are one with existence. Suddenly you start understanding the language of the birds and the language of the trees. Suddenly you attain to a primeval unity. And that unity still exists at the deepest core of your being, where you are connected with it. That's what I was saying the other day. You are still connected with the stream, with the current of sound, or whatever you call it. God, Logos, Nirvana, current of the soundless sound, Sabad, whatever you call it. You are still connected there, just only in the head you have become disconnected. And it is good that only in the head you have become disconnected. If you had become really disconnected at the very roots, then there was no way to be reconnected. There you are still one with the stream. That's why when you go to the sea, something starts bubbling in you. You are still one with the sea. When you see the tidal waves of the sea and the sound and the roars, something starts roaring in you. Your inside sea starts responding. Man was born in the sea. Man was born as a fish. And still, the same story is repeated with each child. Each child in the mother's womb exists in the sea, a small sea. And the contents of the water in the mother's womb are exactly those that of sea water. Exactly. It is as salty as the sea water. That's why pregnant women start eating more salt. They need more salt. They have to create a small ocean, a small sea inside themselves. The child again is born as a fish. In those 9 months in the mother's womb, he has to pass millions of years. Fast he goes with jet speed. But he has to pass all the stages. And even you, when you are not in your mother's womb, your body contains seawater. And not in a small quantity. 80% you are seawater. 80%. And in your body, the water has to contain the same saltiness as the sea. That's why if you miss salt, you don't feel energy. You don't feel vital. You feel weak. That's why salt is one of the most necessary things in life. Even the poorest man has to have salt. In India, the poorest will have only 2-3 things. But if their needs are reduced to the bare minimum, then bread and salt. Salt is a must. Without salt, life starts disappearing. You are still carrying a sea inside you. When you go to the sea, your inner sea starts responding. Waves starts arising. Have you seen sometimes a veena player, a sitar player, or have you tried yourself? There are many strings on the sitar. Just strike a note on one string, a certain note, and you will be surprised. All the other untouched strings resound with the same note. That is the unity of life. That's what happens with a master. He goes on playing a certain note in his being, and the same note starts resounding in your being, in the being of the disciple. This is satsanga. Sooner or later, you start hearing the inner sounds. You start hearing the inner melody. You go to the sea speaks to your inner sea. That's why the full moon night you are so much affected. More people go mad on a full moon night than any other night. More poetry is born on full moon night, and more love, of course. In every language of the world, there are words which relate madness with the moon. In English, the lunatic comes from lunar, the moon. In every language there are words which show the connection with madness. Something happens between the moon and the mind. Just as the sea goes mad when the moon is full, your inner sea also goes mad when the moon is full. You are connected. When you go into a deep forest and you come on that primeval silence of the forest, something resounds in you, a nostalgia. You remember. Something inside starts coming up to the surface. You carry all the experiences of all existence in you. When you go to the Himalayas, it is not the Himalayas only that makes you feel so silent. Himalayas can only resound something in you. An inner Himalaya is there. Man has lived in the mountains. The fresh air and the virgin snows and something virgin in you arises up. We are one. This is what Zen people call when we attain reality. It is seen to be neither personal nor impersonal. Then one knows it is neither personal nor impersonal. Both words are useless. God is not a person. And God is neither impersonal. Then what God is? Difficult to say. Ineffable God is. It is an experience of organic unity with the whole. And the whole is not personal nor impersonal. All those kinds of words that depend on dualities become meaningless. they have to be dropped. That's why Jain people are silent about God. They don't say a word. If you make a statue of God, it becomes personal. If you don't make a statue of God like Mohammedans, it becomes impersonal. But the reference remains the same, the person. Personal or impersonal. Hindus and Mohammedans are not very much different. One makes the statues, the other destroys them. But both believe somehow in the same thing. One worships, one destroys. But both are clinging to something deep down which is the same. One thinks God is personal, one thinks God is impersonal. God is neither. All our words fall short. God only is. Isness is God. Now can you call isness personal or impersonal? When the moon is reflected in the stream, is it personal or impersonal? And when the wind blows through the pines, is it personal or impersonal? Those words make no sense. It is. The wind blowing in the pines is blowing in the pines. And the moon reflected in the stream is reflected in the stream. It is. All that can be said is, it is. That is the meaning of the word Tathatha. It is. There is no sin, no paradise, no loss or gain. About this transcendentality, no question. A great statement of immense significance. There is no sin, no paradise. All sin is created because of our idea of how things should be. We cannot accept as things are. We want to impose our will on existence. We are continuously trying to impose our will on existence. Things should be like this. But when the wind is blowing through the pines, is it virtue or sin? And when the moon is reflected in the stream, is it moral or immoral? Reality simply is. There is no sin, no paradise. And if there is no sin, how can there be hell? Because if there is no sin, there can be no punishment. If there is no sin, there can be no virtue and no avars and no rewards. There can be no paradise. Just the other day I was saying that what Karan Singh says is utter nonsense. Seven hell, seven heaven, just creating fiction to exploit people. There is no hell, no heaven. Hell is nothing but imagination. Imagination of pain, misery. And heaven is again imagination. Imagination of all the pleasant experiences that have happened to you. And you want them again and again and again. And you want them forever. Life simply is. And life is here now. There is no sin, no paradise, no loss or gain. I said this is a great statement. One needs a great heart to understand it. The narrow person will be confused. The narrow-minded will be very much disturbed. It needs a wide opening, a sky-like open heart. There is no loss, no gain. That is all greed, loss and gain. That is what I call the irreligious person who always thinks in terms of loss and gain. People come to me and they ask, we are interested in meditation. We see your people dancing and singing. But can we ask, what will be the real gain? Real gain? Is not singing and dancing enough? What do you want by real gain? something tangible, something that you can carry home and show to your neighbor, that look, I have got meditation and you don't have. Something that you can place in your drawing room to impress people, that look, this is meditation. What do you mean by gain? But the greedy mind, the business mind, continuously thinks in those terms. And because of this greedy mind, there are people who go on exploiting. They say there will be great gain. Maharishi Mahesh Yogi goes on saying to people that not only there will be spiritual gain, there will be economic, financial gain also. If you meditate, you will earn more. Riches will be attracted towards you if you meditate more. If you meditate, you will succeed. Now what kind of rubbish is this? But that's what people want. This has been my experience and my observation. Since the so-called Indian gurus have started going to the West, no Indian guru has been able to transform the West, but the West has been able to transform all Indian gurus. Rather than helping them to meditate, they become all businessmen. They start talking their language, that this will be the game, that you will not have heart attacks, that you will have a more successful life. That you will be more famous, that you will get more friends, that your marriage life will be a happy life. Meditation has nothing to do with these things. Meditation is sheer joy. And meditation happens only to those people who are not asking for such things. If they are asking for such things, it can't happen. And those who go on promising you that these things will happen, meditation has not happened to them either. Because a man who knows what meditation is cannot cheat you. There is no sin, no paradise, no loss or gain. About this transcendentality, no questions. And questions cannot be asked about it. Either you experience it or you don't. And questions cannot help you to experience it either. Just go under the sky and watch. Feel the wind blowing through the pine trees. Become the wind passing through the pine trees. And sometimes become the pine trees. And feel it. Religion has to be felt. Become the stream and reflect the moon. Or become the moon and be reflected by the stream. And if your meditation goes deeper, you can become both together. The moon and the stream both together. And those are the experiences of God. That's why I say Zen is going to be the religion of the future. Because the religion of future will be aesthetical. It will not be ethical. The religions of the past were ethical, moralistic, Puritan. The religion of the future will be aesthetical. Beauty will be its value. And all else will arise out of the feeling for beauty. The past religions have been prose. the future religion is going to be that of poetry. In the past, if somebody was fasting, it was thought to be grace. That is not going to be so in the future. If somebody is dancing, then he will be thought to be a saint. Fasting, what it has to do with religion? The man is a methodist, is pathological, needs psychological treatment. He is killing himself and you are worshipping him. You are also part. If he is going to hell, he will take you to hell. If there is any hell, you both will be there. Because he tortured himself and you help him to torture himself. You are violent. When you worship a man because he is fasting, you are being violent. You are inhuman. Because if you go on worshipping him, he will have to torture himself more and more. That's what happens. If he wants his ego to be fulfilled, he wants more and more people to worship him and think him as a saint, he will go on practicing more and more fasting. He will find more subtle ways of torturing himself. He will lie down on a bed of thorns. Or he will start beating himself every morning. There have been a sect, Christian sect. And the greatest saint was one who will flog his body to blood every morning. And people will come and watch. Just think of those people. They will watch. And the saints are flogging their body. And blood is coming. And their body are tortured. And people are watching with glee. And seeing who is the greatest saint, who can torture himself the most. Now these saints were ill, and the people who had come to see them were also ill. In Russia there has been a Christian sect in which men will cut their genital organs and women will cut their breasts, and they were thought to be great saints. And when this ceremony will happen, thousands will gather to see. What kind of world we have lived in the past, and what kind of people we have been thinking to be religious. The new religion is going to be aesthetical, poetic. A man will be thought religious if he paints beauty, sings beauty, dances beauty, if he has grace, if his life is a joy, and not only a joy in himself, but an overflowing, a superabundance of joy. Not only that he is blissful, he shares his bliss. That is going to be the religion of the future. And the first hints of it has happened in Zen. It is only the Zen masters who have been painting and writing poetry. These are the first glimpses of an aesthetic revolution. And my feeling is that if a man has the sense of beauty, he cannot be bad. Because all badness is ugly. The man who has a sense of beauty is bound to be good and without any cultivation of good. The goodness will be just natural. It will follow his aesthetic sense of beauty. Let beauty be your God. There is no sin, no paradise, no loss or gain. About this transcendentality, no question. Don't be philosophic. Be religious. Don't speculate. Experience. Who is thoughtless? Who is birthless? Don't go on thinking about these things. These are questions. What is God? What is soul? What is paradise? Don't go on thinking about these things. You will never solve them. And all answers that will be given will create more questions and nothing else. Who is thoughtless? Who is this witness? Who meditates? Who arrives? Don't ask these questions. Arrive, meditate, witness, become thoughtless and see. And you will come to know who is birthless, who is deathless. Life is birthless, life is deathless. Life continues. Forms go on changing. Forms are momentary. Life is eternal. But remember that eternity is expressed through moments. Don't create a separation between the moment and the eternal. And don't start searching for the eternal. And don't start sacrificing the momentary. Because the eternal expresses itself through the momentary. The soul expresses itself through the body. And the God has not made the world, God has become the world. If God has made the world, then He remains separate, aloof. God has become the world. Declare it. Go to the housetop and declare it to the whole world. God has become the world. Now there is no more any duality between God and the world. There is nothing like God and the world. The world is divine. The world is Godful. It is a Godfulness. It is a Godliness. There is no other God beyond it. It is here. It is now. In me, in you, in the world, in the trees. This moment. But live it. Experience it. Enough for today.